I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Urbanite radio stories on The Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Maren Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting its 2009-2010 season featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Yitzhak Broman, and more. Tickets to the Meyerhoff available at 410-783-8000 or bsmusic.org. And this hour is a Urbanite radio story. Every month we take articles from the Urbanite magazine as their radio partner, they're our print partner, and we turn these stories into on-air conversations or documentaries or whatever fits that particular article. In this hour, we've taken the article written by Michael Amft called Let's Get Small. Should we shrink our cities is the question that this article wrestles with. We're going to talk about that. Baltimore being one of those cities that has shrunk. When I was a young boy in the city, we were close to a million people. Now we're down to about 629,000, if I have about that right. Mm-hmm. And some folks think we should make it smaller. Some folks think that we should just leave it where it is, that growth is a bad thing. Some people think growth is a good thing. Cities across the country in the Rust Belt have lost population as they become deindustrialized. So we're going to debate that this hour. Let's get your thoughts on the airwaves on that at 410-319-8888. We're joined in studio by Commissioner Paul Graziano, of course, Baltimore Housing Commissioner. Paul, good to see you again.
Same here, Mark.
Beth Stroman's with us in studio once again. She's manager of Baltimore's Office of Sustainability.
Hi,
Department
Mark.
Of Planning. Department of Planning, right?
Yes, that's right.
Dan Kildee's with us, who was prominent in this article. Dan Kildee is the county treasurer of Genesee County, which is Flint, Michigan, where Flint, Michigan is. He is also executive director of their land bank and is a noted leader of the Shrink City movement. And we've heard rumors from one of our guests today that you're actually running for governor of Michigan. Is that true?
Well, there's speculation about that, but you never know what's going to happen in the world of politics.
You certainly don't. Or as Bob Marley put it, the world of politics, which you never know.
Right.
Yes. So you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to Facebook and throw your ideas out there right now. Should we shrink our cities? Let's talk about what this means. I mean, I this whole notion of shrinking cities. And let me turn to Dan Kildee first, since you've become something of a national spokesperson on this particular issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a very provocative term.
Yes.
But in its real application, it's actually just the simple application of logic. Many cities in America have lost population, a significant population. And just using my own hometown of Flint as an example, mm-hmm. we've lost 45% of our population. So we really have a couple of choices. We can either operate on the pretense that somehow in the next couple of years, you know, in our case, 85,000 people are going to move back to Flint, or we can decide that we're going to reshape our city so that we have a physical footprint, a built environment that more logically accommodates the actual population that our community has. So, you know, I think often the shrinking notion sounds like actually changing the borders of a city or deciding that some neighborhoods are just going to disappear. Not so. But the physical layout, the balance between supply and demand for housing and commercial space needs to be rationalized. And so it's a design question as much as it is a supply-demand question. So often it sounds like a much more dramatic and provocative concept when in truth it's simple logic.
Now, Beth Stroman, when we talked about this very briefly, in downtown Baltimore just the other week, we were in a meeting together. You had different ideas about what that means to you. You weren't quite taken with the notion of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what are your thoughts on this idea?
Well, I think actually as a lifelong urbanite, you know, just the term shrinking cities, you know, kind of gives me a knee-jerk reaction because I really love cities. And but I do agree that what we call it around here actually is right-sizing. Perhaps,
mm-hmm.
because in Baltimore, actually, at our original population of around a million people was, in some respects, a lot of people would argue it was too dense. Okay, there, you know, you can have high density, but you also have to have really good design to go with it. And there was not necessarily in some neighborhoods that good design. So I understand the concept. And in Baltimore, we have not lost quite the amount of population that Flint and some of the other cities have. And also, we're actually seeing a slowdown in the population loss. And in fact, we feel like we're probably bottoming out, if you will. And also our population in the of children, believe it or not, 0 to 5 range, has actually increased for the first time in decades. So we're seeing some positive trends here. But does that mean that we don't have empty neighborhoods that need to be re-envisioned, if you will?
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. And also we're seeing shifts within our boundaries along the waterfront where there was industrial development. Now we have people living there. And along the Middle Branch waterfront, which is Baltimore's next inner harbor, we could have anywhere from 1,700 to 5,000 new housing units.
Paul, what is your notion when you hear? I mean, as housing commissioner, you've been housing commissioner. How long have you been head of housing in Baltimore?
About 9 years now.
I figure it was a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while.
You could actually retire from this job. You
well,
could do
who knows?
But go ahead. What's your response to this?
Well, I think that I'll pick up on both themes. I don't think there's a lot of difference between the two positions here. The fact is that Baltimore has lost a third of its population. So in a sense, it has shrunk from close to a million to 629,000, 30,000. But I do believe that the prescription for Baltimore is to not, quote, shrink further. I think that we are at a stable population and, in fact, can sustain a larger population, although I would agree with Beth that we don't really seek to achieve that near 1 million population that we had in 1950. I think that there are opportunities out there, but there are some realities. The realities are that we have about 30,000 vacant lots and vacant structures in this city, and that's reflective of losing a third of the population. And we must plan around that. We must operate in that context. So I think that that's really what Dan is getting at, that you can't ignore the reality. There are logical realities that one must deal with. I think that we have some basic demographics that are perhaps a bit better than some other cities. I don't like to stack one city up against another, but I know that some of the Midwestern cities in the mm-hmm. industrial heartland have been very, very hard hit, and I feel for those places and those people. We are perhaps a little bit better positioned given our proximity to D.C. And with the BRAC base realignment activity and so forth, that I think there is opportunity and we will likely see some significant additional household creation in the city. And it may not result in huge population increase, but one of the phenomena that we're seeing is more households, but smaller households than there were, say, 50 years ago. So you can have units, housing units, an expansion in units without a dramatic increase in population.
Well, I'm going to kind of challenge some of the notions here and see what we think about this. I mean, I'm curious, those of you who have grown up in cities, those of you who maybe grew up in Baltimore, or maybe you grew up in D.C., but grew up wherever you grew up, remember the city as it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago. 50 years ago, and talk about where cities should go and why they've changed so much. I mean, one of the things we know is that one of the reasons Baltimore's changed is deindustrialization. We've lost jobs, and integration made a lot of white people flee Baltimore City and move to the county, and integration built a black middle class that also kind of began moving out of Baltimore into Randallstown and other communities around Baltimore. However, what you said a minute ago, Beth, I mean, I was thinking, is a million people too much for Baltimore City? I mean, I remember as a kid, and I'm old enough to remember that time, even though it was during segregation, one of the things that the city had was it had an incredible transportation system, which we don't have now. Now we have one that is disgusting and doesn't work. But then when we were kids, there were trolleys that took you from one end of the city to the county and back and everywhere you wanted to go, from Dundalk to Woodlawn to the center of the city. I mean, they went everywhere. Essex, I mean, you just took a trolley anywhere you wanted to go. And almost every neighborhood had a commercial district where you had a drugstore and you had a place to buy your food and you had a shoe store and you had a pool hall and a bowling alley. And like I'm thinking about, you know, like whether it's Walbrook Junction or Garrison Liberty Heights or anywhere, Highland Town, Pennsylvania Avenue, there were commercial areas. So every neighborhood had a hub. Mm-hmm. And I think the city, beyond the issues of segregation, which were horrendous and needed to end, was a very livable place with a million people. Who says that a million-person city is not a livable place? Let me turn to Dan Kildee.
Well, it can be perfectly livable, but the one thing that is for sure, that in order for a community or a city to be livable with a million people, is that you got to get a million people. And many of these cities, I mean, it's not a theoretical question as to what is the optimal size. For most of the cities, it's a question of what can the economy, what can the infrastructure, what is the actual, what are the facts on the ground? And are we going to cling to a belief that we should be something else and have a constant struggle of defining success in unattainable terms? Or are we going to realize that cities grow, they expand, economies deliver residents to a particular community, and then economies change, environments change, and now we have a city in many cases which is smaller than it once was. Rather than saying to ourselves that the definition of success is based upon some abstraction, like a population number, we ought to define define success in other terms. What is life like for the people who live there? So I don't mean to evade the question, but I think the question presupposes that having a million people would make it a better place. And there's nothing in evidence that shows that cities have better quality based on that population figure. It's a good conversation because, you know, sometimes people think that this notion implies that growth is bad. Growth is not bad at all. I'd love Flint to grow, for example. I'd love to see Detroit grow. But I just don't think that it's fair to the people who live in the community to presuppose that the only way that their lives can improve is if we somehow convince a whole bunch of other people that they need to move back or to move in.
Well, let me ask this question. I don't know the situation in Genesee County in Flint, Michigan, but let me ask this question.
Sure.
The Michigan itself, you have property taxes, correct?
We do.
All right. Are the property taxes statewide or jurisdictional?
They're jurisdictional, although some of them are statutory for school taxes. So
okay.
They're right. Uniform.
But I'm going to throw out a really cockamamie idea here and talk about maybe and one of the underpinnings of this whole worry about where cities are going and how much money there is for a city to survive in and how we develop our state, any state in the union, has a lot to do with property taxes. The fact that we have to pay, each jurisdiction has their own property tax structure, so that developers and others have a huge amount of sway because every jurisdiction wants the property taxes for its schools and other things that inside. So maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe part of the problem is not everything in this article, which we'll get back to as well, but maybe part of the problem is that this tax structure is antiquated and ridiculous and just divides states up so that suburbs and rural areas and cities battle each other for development rather than making it a much more even process. You can still self-govern, but you don't have to have fight over every piece of taxes. Then we wouldn't be thinking about shrinking or anything like that.
I agree. I mean, yeah. I think one of the problems that I face in dealing with this concept is to have to explain that this is a complicated situation. If we had policy that truly valued cities, which we do not, tax structures, generally speaking, across the states, do not favor cities. Development tools have actually driven more people out of cities than brought them back to cities. I'm religiously pro-urban. So I think on one hand, we shouldn't walk away from that argument. We clearly have a tax structure, certainly in Michigan, that encourages development on greenfields and discourages reuse of the existing built environment. We need to fix that. But my point is that in the meantime, for the next 15 or 20 years or 5 years or whatever it is, we also have to treat people who are residents of the city with some care and to build a city that is actually functional based on the population that's there right now.
Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, it's certainly true that the search for tax base does pervert the process and create some strange investment patterns and municipalities competing with one another. And in some cases, the jurisdictions have looked at regional tax policies, tax-based sharing and so forth to try to have a good solid plan and direct the investment to the places where it ought to go. And long term, I think that would be a great thing. I think that we're not going to get there soon. Obviously, we do recognize that the tax rate in the city of Baltimore is a deterrent to investment at a certain level. Obviously, it's a concern to all those who live here. And I know Mayor Dixon shares that concern and is committed to getting that rate down through whatever means, including the slots development and the proceeds from that. So that would definitely be a good thing to bring, reduce the rate help to equalize, come closer to equity between the city and the suburbs. But, I mean, we have to deal with what we have, which is a city of 630,000 that has certainly has room for growth. And, in fact, the city's comprehensive plan does call for a target population of about 770,000. So we're not talking about shrinkage. Our plan does contemplate significant growth, but that would still be significantly below the 1 million that was the high water mark.
I guess I'm not so much asking for a million people to come back to Baltimore or 1.5 million or go down to 500,000. I personally could care less what our population is.
Mm-hmm.
but I'm more interested in what our city is like.
Well, I guess, you know, my take on this is, you know, using this as an opportunity to take advantage of the shifts and the changes in population to rethink some of our land use patterns, for example, and our zoning to create what really livable spaces, okay? Make sure that even should we suddenly get lucky, things change, whatever, population comes back, if it was a million, we do it in the right way. We do it in a way that's sustainable, that incorporates the green spaces and public health issues into it, that takes into account new and improved transit systems, for example, so that people aren't forced to drive everywhere. That would be my concern with all of this. As we move forward, that whatever we do, what's in place can accommodate the growth while also having a great place to live for the people that are here.
I mean, one of the things I think I've seen when we talk about redeveloping cities and shrinking them sometimes means, and maybe you all will take issue with this, but I'm going to lay it out here anyway, and I want to hear our listeners think at 410-319-8888, and is that, now, I have not been to Flint in years. But I've seen it in Michael Moore's movies, but I haven't been to Flint in a long time. But I spent time there a long time ago. And in Baltimore, part of what we've done is try to attract people of means to the city.
Right.
And so what we've done, and I've always been kind of a champion against this, but I've lost every battle on this, is that what that means is that we've taken the most prime real estate in Baltimore, which is the waterfront, and turn it over to people who have money. So we have a walkway around the harbor, but you can't get to the water, and you're blocked off from the water. You can't get it. Unless you have a lot of money to buy a very expensive condo, you're not near the water. People in Canton redid their homes, and all of a sudden somebody had money, and they were allowed to build these townhomes that cost a huge amount of money, block off the water, block off the view, and it's not there anymore. So is that what we mean by redesigning a city? Is that what we want to do, to turn a city into a place that is a playground for people with money but nobody else?
Absolutely
no,
not.
No,
I mean,
no.
You wanna?
Yeah, no, the waterfront is a tiny portion of the entire city, and it's ironic because the waterfront used to be the working gritty waterfront.
I remember it.
And the beautiful neighborhoods out there in the city were where people wanted to be, with the big houses and some of the further out with the large yards and so forth. And it's only in the last 20 years or so, I guess, that the waterfront, maybe 30, has become very trendy. And that's true of a lot of cities. But the waterfront is really, it'll take care of itself. We try to focus more out in the neighborhoods of the city. That's where the vast majority of the people live. That is where the vast majority of the opportunities are. That's where, obviously, where the vast majority of vacant land is right now. We have to focus on those areas, and Beth is absolutely correct. It's about quality of life because, you know, density is actually not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And if we could focus that density in ways that create, for instance, transit nodes and retail centers that you described from your youth, that's a good thing. But then that leaves some other land for more green space, which this city often did not have a lot of. We've got a few very large parks, but in a lot of neighborhoods, there was virtually no green space when you think about it. You know, row after row of block after block of row houses without
green space. You know what you'll find, Mark, that the communities with the least amount of green space were the lower income, the poorer communities. Okay, so you know, if you track the communities with the least number of trees, you'll find those are our poorer communities today. You know, that is one of the key things we have to change. Okay, we're concentrating in Tree Baltimore with planting these areas and incorporating. We're going to probably have some actual urban agriculture going on around Baltimore, which I think is a very exciting.
We have hoop houses were just built in
Clifton Park.
Clifton Park.
Right.
Let me go back to our guest Dan Kildee. I mean, I'm curious your thought on what I was just saying. I mean, Baltimore could be any city in the critique that I just laid out.
Well, I mean, design matters, and design has to incorporate all sorts of elements. The physical footprint of the city, but what's within that? Designing housing and developing housing that mixes incomes and that provides for an adequate mix of affordable and market rate and high-end housing. All those elements of a plan, I think, are critical, and they're unique to each community. The physical geography of each community is different. But, you know, I think the conversation is the right one. Delivering amenities into neighborhoods that may be middle-income or lower-income neighborhoods is absolutely critical. It's one of the things that we've been doing here is a significant amount of regreening in what has traditionally been lower moderate-income neighborhoods. So, you know, this whole question really is a question of design and whether or not, and this is a subject that is a different subject of debate, but whether or not we as, you know, public officials are going to use the tools that people give us in government to try to affect a design in the city that is more equitable and delivers more fairly to a broad range of people the amenities that make for a quality community. And I think that's they're going to be different in Baltimore as it is than it is in Flint or Detroit, but it's really essentially the same set of questions.
410-319-8888. What should the future of our cities be? What should they look like? What do you want to do with the abandoned lots and say over 17,000 in the city, at least 30,000 abandoned homes in the city, if not many more than that? And how should we look? How should we get around? What kind of city should be our city of the future here? 410-319-8888. This concept called shrinking the city doesn't mean running people out of the city so much as just trying to figure out what to do with cities with shrinking populations. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Baba, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, I do see this as a ghost town. You know, a lot of abandoned. I do a lot of traveling, and a lot of abandoned buildings, as y'all spoke about. And this is happening in the community of my people. And so I wanted to ask the question, why is the government still allowing drugs to come in this country and the liquor stores, all of that to be set up, you know, every other block? You know, it appears to me it's designed that way. It's designed that way.
Well, I mean, I think, let me take this one part of your question. I think we can handle the kind of drugs coming into America. I mean, that's another issue that is huge that every community in America faces, not just cities. But there is a question, like when you talk about what do you want a city to look like, and there are...
Yes, I want it to look like Africa.
Oh. Okay, well, Africa's not a city, it's a continent, but we do have in Baltimore, and I suppose it might be very similar in Flint, every corner has two things. You always should be the joke in Baltimore. You had a church on one corner and a bar on the other. And that this was a city of bars, and we're working class down with bars, and some people are upset about what that has done to a lot of communities because it's not as it was in the 1950s and 60s where a bar was a place where families would go and you would come home after work, have a beer, and then head to your house. How is it in Flint? I'm very curious, Dan.
Well, I mean, the neighborhoods that have lost population have lost virtually all commercial enterprise. And so what we have is not just abandoned houses, but we've got wholesale abandonment of commercial space. And so you have these long stretches of streets and houses that are disconnected to one another, and disconnected to any kind of commercial enterprise. There's not a grocery store. There's not a, you know, a barber or a dry cleaners. There's not even a bar. There's the occasional, what we call in Michigan, party store, you know, which is a euphemism for, you know, high-cost, low-quality grocer with, you know, that sells liquor and cups, basically. But that's rare. So, I mean, the elements that make up a community is much more than a row of houses with people living there. It's made up of lots of other things. So,
well, I think short break and come right back and kind of rest with this some more with our guests and your thoughts, Mackenzie and the others who are calling in, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on what the city, our city, should look like, cities across the nation should look like. What are the cities of the 21st century? 410-319-8888. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are talking about the future of cities and whether or not you'll be shrinking cities or growing them, and what does that all really mean? It's part of one of our Urbanite Radio stories in this month's issue. How should we build is the name of this issue, and it was the article called The Incredible Shrinking City by Michael Amft. And one of the people in that article featured greatly in the article, who's one of the national spokespeople for this whole idea of what our cities should be in the future, is Dan Kildee, who is treasurer of Genesee County, which is Flint, Michigan. He's also the head of their land bank, head of our land bank, and housing commissioners in the studio as well, Paul Graziano, and Beth Stroman, who is manager of Baltimore's Office of Sustainability. Let me go right to the phones, if I might. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And Travis in Richmond, Virginia, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, Travis. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on, I'm actually a city planning major at Virginia Commonwealth University, and we've been studying what mixed-use development zoning and how it can improve green space within the city. Just wanted to hear some comments on that.
On mixed-use communities. And that mixed-use community idea, I mean, I'm curious what's happened in Flint. I want to talk about what's happened here because it's had really mixed results, really mixed results. What's the situation in Flint?
Well, much of the development that we've done through our land bank is mixed-use development in our city center.
And define that for me, from your perspective.
Well, I mean, this is where we have housing, commercial space, office space, all essentially in the same on the same footprint of land, where you can essentially have neighborhoods above, on second stories and office space, all in the same environment, so that we don't segregate land use by type, but actually integrate land use and theoretically is intended to make for a more sustainable community. In our case, it is working. It's working to an extent. Taking that concept into the neighborhoods is a little more difficult, but in our downtown, we've seen a real resurgence. In little old Flint, Michigan, we've got about $100 million of new construction underway right now, and that is not what you'd expect to hear from a city that is losing population. So it does prove that cities that are struggling, or cities that are shrinking, so to speak, is not necessarily a city that has surrendered. And mixed-use development is one way to create a more compact environment and actually have some real vibrancy.
How do you think it's worked here?
I think that the notion of total segregation of uses is outmoded, outdated. It really is antithetical to community building and to sustainability. I think the notion of having housing in one place and having to get in a car and go some distance to do your shopping or to even to work, is not the ideal situation. So I think we certainly have tried to encourage mixed use, and certainly the comprehensive plan and the rezoning that's going on or that's underway now looks to encourage that throughout the city.
Right. And the success of any individual mixed-use project, again, gets down to really the individual project and its location, the design within that project, the actual level of mix of uses. You know, you have to have a certain population to support a commercial or you know, other type of use. You can't just say, oh, this coffee shop will survive if there's not enough of a population around there. So you really have to take all those things into account as you design your mixed use. And I would just add to that that, you know, these mixed use entities or these areas function best also in conjunction with transit-oriented development,
right.
You know, where you can really start to integrate populations and activities. And that's what we want to do in Baltimore is really concentrate them in those areas.
I mean, we asked me to concentrate on getting the transit right. That would help.
Yes.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Mackenzie, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm from Baltimore, and I'd like to see more high-end retail. I go to D.C. a lot, to Georgetown and other areas there, and here it's not too many high-end retail shops or boutiques where you can go and just shop among a stretch of stores for high-end retail. And so I'd like to see more of that in the city.
We would love to provide it.
But
you know, I don't think there's the demand necessarily here at this time.
Yeah, we're not going to quite reach Rodeo Drive standards. But certainly, you know, we seek to bring in more business and a range of price points and so forth. And that's always been our goal. Obviously, BDC works on that a lot more, for instance, than we do in housing. But and in fact, they're constantly out there recruiting businesses. But you have to be able to demonstrate to them that there's a sustainable market. What we have focused an awful lot on is bringing grocery stores into the neighborhoods of the city, and grocery stores really are an anchor to communities, and been a tremendous growth in the number of new stores and expanded and improved stores, grocery stores, throughout the city, even over the last 7 or 8 years.
410-319-8888. Who is up here next at bat is George. You're on the air.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, George.
Hey.
Hey, I just wanted to make a comment and ask a question. My comment is I think Baltimore is due for a facelift. I think a lot of the buildings or a lot of the houses in Baltimore have seen their best days. Like if you drive down the stretch of North Avenue,
yep.
A lot of the homes are really old. They had their heyday, and now I think it's time for, you know, a facelift in our city and a just a massive renovation. And my question is, I was wondering how doable is it, especially in areas like East Baltimore, specifically Middle East, if we could just tear down blocks of properties where there's only like one house or two houses on a whole block, and maybe, you know, move those residents to a block that would be more, you know, that they maybe have like a few houses available. And just for some of these blocks that, you know, where there are just, you know, blocks and blocks of people, well, blocks and blocks of homes where no one's really living in them except for maybe one person. Is it doable maybe through eminent domain to just, you know, bulldoze those blocks and just, you know, maybe build some new, maybe greener properties or greener living places?
Yes, in fact, such things are happening in East Baltimore. What you just described in the Middle East area of East Baltimore is, in fact, the East Baltimore Development Initiative, which is an 88-acre area that was characterized by vast amounts of vacant land and abandoned houses and shuttered businesses. Which is being redeveloped into a new, very much mixed income and mixed use community. And in fact, it required massive amounts of acquisition and clearance and relocation. It is extremely expensive. It is extremely difficult to do in a way that is sensitive to the people who live there, because our goal has not been to remove people, but to work with folks so that they have the right to return, or if they want to go to another community, that they land in a good spot. It's a challenge, but it's certainly something that needs to be done in places that have hit the level of abandonment that section of East Baltimore had experienced.
I mean, what George was saying, I just explore before we go to Leon and Jane, our next two callers up. And I like to get Dan Kildy into this and Beth as well. I mean, especially here in the Flint example. I mean, one of the issues here, I mean, if you go through Baltimore, and I know it's like that in Flint, today I was in a neighborhood in Baltimore called Park Heights. It was Park Heights between Park Circle and Northern Parkway, which is poor, depressed African-American neighborhood, and where it is just glutted with empty, boarded-up houses. It is that, you know, the people don't have work. It's just like an armed camp in some ways on both sides, of the law divide. So what do you do with communities that people don't want to move out of their homes? We're not going to move masses of people into Park Heights, but something has to be done to bring neighborhoods like that back to life. I'd like to hear what your thoughts on that are for cities in your own state, like Detroit and Flint.
Right. I think, you know, it's one of the differences, I think, between a place like Flint and Baltimore in that the type of housing that we have here does give us more flexibility than the type of housing that you have there in Baltimore, in that virtually all of the housing here in Flint is single-family detached homes. So the situation that you describe is one that actually can be returned to almost a rural condition in a neighborhood, so that the people who do choose to stay, who really love their home, can have a choice of either being surrounded by something green and open, we have a lot of urban agriculture going in our community right now, or if they choose to leave, currently they have no choice. They really don't have a choice, because they have no way to convert their equity, their ownership, into something that allows them to buy into another community. So we're exploring, at least just thinking through, what Jay Williams, the mayor of Youngstown, has proposed, and that is that the folks who do want to leave in those areas that have completely lost their market be given some incentive, some inducement to go into a neighborhood that's more sustainable by allowing them to recapture some of the theoretical equity that they've lost through essentially a voucher or a credit toward the acquisition of a property in a neighborhood that can be sustained.
Then what happens to those neighborhoods?
Well, in those neighborhoods, then they can go back to nature.
You're talking about literally go back to nature?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're going back to nature now anyway, but the problem is in places like Flint and Detroit, they're going back to nature in the most destructive way, and that is incrementally over time. My thought is, you know, if we have a population that that can support a certain footprint of neighborhoods, we ought to be using the very tools that have been used historically to sprawl and grow and gobble up all sorts of open farmland. We ought to use those same sorts of inducements to connect people back to one another in sustainable neighborhoods. And if that means that some areas that were once high-density neighborhoods now can become something natural and contribute to the quality of the community without having to have a structure built upon it, then I think that's a worthy goal.
I mean, you have places, I know that in Cleveland, there's an interesting project going on. I've talked to folks at University of Maryland who are working on it. I'd like to go out there and just see it, where, like, unlike, let's say, Hopkins on the east side, where there's been redevelopment, what they've done there is put people in those neighborhoods to work so people stay in their homes, as well as move new people in. By that, I mean, they've created, let's say, a laundry business that would do all the laundry of an institution that's Hopkins equivalent in that Cleveland neighborhood. So it's put to work hundreds of people who take home salaries with health benefits. We have to start thinking really creatively and differently, and not the same old tear it down, build it up, bring people in.
Right.
We got to come up with some new ideas to make cities alive and work. We just can't do what we've been doing.
That's correct.
In all these bureaucratic years that we've spent.
And it hasn't worked necessarily. You know, it's, I think, as Dan says, you have to accept that, you know, you're not always going to attract a population back. In Park Heights, you use that as an example. There has been an incredible effort it's a combination of the City of Baltimore, Baltimore Development Corporation, and the community of Park Heights, Greater Park Heights, the Park Heights Renaissance, where everybody sat down and looked at the situation that's there and said, well, what are we going to do about this? You know, what do we want this? What is our vision for the future, and how are we going to get there? Recognizing that in some cases, there's going to be places that are going to be removed. They may be vacant for some time. Thinking about what would be that use in the interim. I mean, Baltimore, we have it's not as simple to return things to nature necessarily, because the vacant lots or vacant areas sometimes become areas of crime or dumping. We may be looking more at something that's natural but has an activity tied to it, like, for example, or again, urban agriculture or something like that, which solves another problem, which is healthy eating and a food supply, and we have a lot of what we call food deserts in the city of Baltimore.
I mean, urban agriculture, I think, is a wave of the future that I know Flint is into. Baltimore's now growing into that world as well. And the hoop houses down in Clifton Park are very exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think that it portends well for the future. But those are the kinds of things we have to start thinking about.
Right.
And
it's also a green job opportunity, of course.
Right.
And
with all fairness, let me just go back to the phone and get some other folks in here. 410-319-8888. George, thank you for that call. Leon, you're on the air. You there, Leon?
Yeah. Good evening, everyone.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Good evening. Yes. Again.
I'm sorry. I apologize if you've already answered this question. I'm a middle-income earning homeowner living in the city, always teetering on, do I stay, do I go, based on quality of life issues. Are there any examples where a city like Baltimore, which has had a high level of poverty, have been able to bring in more middle-income earners without throwing poor people out on the street, so to speak, but also doing it in a way that reduces crime by bringing in more opportunity?
Let me ask you a quick question before I let you go, Liam. Define for me what you mean by middle-income.
I own a home. I make roughly between 50 and 70.
Okay, that's right. Okay, I'm just making sure we just what we're talking about.
Yeah. Let me just say
that I can make a lot more.
But amen to that.
let me just say that I think there is ample opportunity to bring in that middle class, as you described it, into Baltimore without displacing low-income residents, because we have these 30,000 vacant houses and lots, and we have tremendous opportunities to attract new population, and I think that there is there's a lot there. There's richness in the architecture and the history of neighborhoods throughout the city, and there are prices that are very, very affordable compared to many other places. Especially for middle class. Obviously, there are some issues of affordability for those at lower incomes, but for those in working families and middle class, there are some real bargains in our communities of Baltimore, even more so today than a couple of years ago. And so, I think that one thing does not have to mean a positive for the middle class moving in doesn't have to mean displacement of those of lower incomes.
Dan, I'm curious. Tell us a bit of the Flint story in regards to this.
Well, I mean, in our community, the real struggle, of course, is that we've got an extraordinarily depressed community, 28% unemployment in the city.
28%?
Right.
It's like in Baltimore City, too, in the inner cities. So, right.
What we are seeing is some return of middle-income earners into the new, interesting, different housing choices that we're putting into the market. And I think this is an important part of any community's housing strategy is to, and it was mentioned earlier, to rethink what a household looks like and not assume that it's single-family detached homes or a row house that everybody wants. Different types of housing have brought different types of residents into our community. So what what we're finding is when we build loft apartments or interesting space, that we do attract a greater mix of incomes. And in our particular case, our land bank has an operating philosophy that all of our development projects of any scale integrate market rate and affordable housing in mm-hmm. a way that essentially erases those lines.
Let me reopen the phones here, 410-319-8888. If you look at the future of our cities, we have in the studio, you just heard on phone, Dan Kildee, who is county treasurer of Genesee County, which is Flint, Michigan. Is where Flint, Michigan is, I should say, and head of their land bank as well. We're also in the studio is Beth Stroman, manager of Baltimore's Office of Sustainability, and our housing commissioner, Paul Graziano. 410-319-8888. This is the Urbanite Radio Hour from Urbanite Magazine. The article, Let's Get Small, talking about the future of our cities. What is the future of our cities, of our city, or our cities? 410-319-8888. Arthur, on the road, you're on the air.
Fine.
Hi, Arthur.
I think a big problem here in Baltimore is that people have, in my opinion, very unrealistic expectations about what can be accomplished and what can be accomplished in a very short time. We look at the deteriorating neighborhoods, and that hasn't happened overnight. That's been happening for decades. And outside of certain neighborhoods like around the harbor and maybe a few other neighborhoods, very little has been put into any kind of physical incentive to keep people wanting to go into the county. And I'm not talking about just the bad schools and the crime situation, but what is there to keep people here? You want a bigger middle class, well, you have to have a critical mass of middle class jobs that will enable people to buy homes here, that will enable them to invest in renovating those homes, and that will give financial incentive to developers and other property owners to upgrade properties to bring more people in.
Mm-hmm.
And in my view, until you've got that, level of middle class employment, professional employment, you're not going to be able to recreate the Baltimore of 40 or 50 years ago, which really was not that much of a middle-class place. It was a working-class place because people worked in factories, people worked at the harbor, people worked in the railroads, and you still had a very relatively small professional class. And it seems to me until you get some way of bringing in those kind of jobs, meaning making this city attractive to corporations, non-profit organizations, of which there has been some success,
mm-hmm.
you need to be able to generate sufficient, sustainable middle-class income to allow developers and others to come in and redevelop neighborhoods on a scale that's going to be sustainable and that's going to make the city more attractive to more people.
I think you raised some very cogent points. I have good history, too, as well. Paul, go ahead. You want to say something?
Yes.
Paul Graziano.
I certainly agree that jobs are critical to attracting the middle class. I would say we have certain advantages here. Certainly we have the whole hospital industry and the universities. Many universities in the city are major power employment bases. Also, our proximity to D.C. I mean, there's an awful lot of people who are doing reverse commuting, working, living here, and living here and commuting to D.C. Has really led to a lot of investment in a lot of communities in the city. And then I mentioned earlier the base realignment and closure process, which is bringing a lot of middle class jobs to the area. So. In many cases, you could have people living here and working outside the city, either through BRAC or D.C. or some of the surrounding areas.
I think one of the things Arthur was saying, that we have, is being realistic about where cities can go. And I think that somebody was saying on the show the other day, we were talking about the ICC, the Inter-County Connector, and mm-hmm. All the money being spent on that, and the billions of dollars being spent on a new highway between Shady Grove and Frederick and the battle that we evolve around that. Mm-hmm. So the question I was curious, and Beth Stroman and then Dan Kildee, then we'll go back to the phones, is when you envision what it means to be a sustainable city in the future, what does it look like? How do we get them? Because if you also accept the fact that we are losing the oil reserves of the world, that we've not figured out how to do the new energy and transport food and what's going to happen to our children and grandchildren and their children, it's going to be a very different world. What does a sustainable city mean to the two of you, Beth and then Dan?
Okay, well, first off, a sustainable city has to really embrace the principles of sustainability, right? Which is people, planet, and prosperity in balance, i.e. communities, the environment, and our economic prosperity are all given the same weight. We're not balancing one over the other, but considering all in relation to one another. So what does that look like then? That means that in terms of our transportation, it's equitable, i.e. there's a whole variety of transportation and it's available to all income levels. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's good transit. That's also good highways. Mixed income communities are imperative. All right, imperative to success. And I have to add, everyone talks about middle class jobs, but my focus is actually on what we call the underemployed, people who need training to get into the job market, people coming out of prison into the reentry programs. Baltimore has a lot of that, and really we're not going to be a success unless these individuals are helped into the regular employment cycle and circles. And then in terms of our environment, making sure that as we do our redevelopment, we consider water quality, we're considering air quality issues, that greening is a key component of that, okay? So that people are exposed to the environment as part of their day-to-day activities in their community, because this is a very healthy thing. So those are three things that I would look at.
Dan?
Well, I think those are right. I think that's a very good definition. I think, to take it one step further, the question is for each community is what is the pathway to sustainability. And it's going to be different for Baltimore than it is for other places. I can tell you what it is for Flint, and that is to immediately get control of this abandoned property and try to start by equalizing supply and demand in the housing market. And until we do that, it's very difficult for us to think about the other steps on the pathway to sustainability. In other words, it's hard to attract employers when a community is blighted and abandoned. It's hard to attract people to a community when the market value of property is so low that there's no likelihood of recovering any equity that a person is willing to put in. So for each community to get to that definition, I think is the proper one, we have to have a strategy and a plan. The notion of shrinking, for me, is a intentionally provocative term to shake a community such as my own into taking that first big step. I mean, I agree that some other softer euphemism would probably get me further in some circles. But my own community, I believe, even though I'm taking a lot of brickbats for it, I desperately needed to hear an intentionally provocative term so that we get on that path as fast as we can.
Dan Kildee, County Treasurer for Genesee County, where Flint, Michigan resides. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure to hear some thoughts from another state. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
And Commissioner Paul Graziano, Beth Stroman, thank you both so much for coming in studio. It's been great to have you both here.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite explains a new movement in architecture and design, debates the downsizing of Baltimore City, which we just did here, and offers an in-depth look behind the state's biggest transportation project, which we did yesterday. It's The Building Issue, available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbaniteBaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. We'll be right back with Ethel Ennis, so stay with us.